this evening on some of the aspects of Buddhist practice, and especially some of those aspects that relate to the question that's, I think, very interesting for me, is the relationship between the individual and the social, in a sense. So how do we as individual practitioners, human beings, men, women, or of indeterminate gender or whatever, how do we practice, our inner practice lead us, and how does this relate to our social role, our role in a culture? So obviously here in a monastery, that role in a culture, we're part of a Buddhist sangha, Buddhist community, Buddhist culture, and that ties us into a whole range of things which aren't necessarily closely connected with what we actually are involved with as spiritual practitioners. When I went down to do this gig at the Camden High School a couple of days ago, and one of the people there said mentioned a old Italian proverb, and he said it's a very common saying in Italy: the church is a whore, but she is always our mother. So there's a nice kind of ambivalence about that kind of saying, which I can kind of relate to fairly well. I don't know of any similar sayings within Buddhism, but we can't help but feel in a sense ambivalent towards our Buddhist tradition, even though we're certainly, I think, for the most part spared some of the excesses that we see in other religions, but we still have our fair share of baggage which we carry into the present day. And yet this seems to have so little with the actual direct experience of the Dhamma, which is why most of us are here. But it's very interesting to see this kind of difference if you go, especially in Asia and traditional Buddhist countries. You know, a lot of people, they talk about their role, or what they want to do is to spread the Dhamma and to spread Buddhism. Whereas when we come from a Western background, really the idea of spreading Buddhism as such is the kind of the last thing in our minds when we come to Buddhist practice. And so most of us come to Buddhist practice because we want to address the actual suffering, the confusion, the doubts that we have in ourselves. So these two quite different directions, each of which has its own benefits and drawbacks. There's something undeniable about the nature of Buddhist practice and Buddhist meditation, which is almost irreducibly individual, no matter how much we feel that we might exist in relationship, in society, as part of a sangha or a spiritual community. We imitate the Buddha. We remember that the essence of the Buddha's life story is to leave his family, leave his home, leave his town, leave everyone behind and go and practice. Eventually he left even his companions, meditation companions, and just went and practiced alone in the forest. And we read some of the verses in praise of this practice just the other day, the rhinoceros horn verses. Ego jare kaga visana kaporo. One should wander alone like a rhinoceros's horn. Indian rhinoceros is having one horn, thus making a more effective simile than the African variety. So, and there's something, I think, quite amazing about that, and something that's sort of very archetypal and very kind of primal, in a way, about that idea. You just go, leave everything behind, the cities left behind, people left behind, there's nothing there, just you and the forest. Is stripped of everything, and it's something which you find is a feature of a lot of the hero mythologies, whether they're overtly spiritual or not. But for example, Gilgamesh leaves behind his friends, his family, everything, and goes in search of the secret of immortality. Odysseus, in the favourite scene in the Odyssey, where everything's lost, all his ships are lost, everything, his treasure, everything is gone, and he's in a storm at sea, his ships are sunk, and he's just alone and naked and clinging onto one piece of driftwood in the middle of the ocean. So to me, these are some of the most primal images of where that spiritual quest will take us. It's somewhere we're completely bereft of society, of people, of any kind of support, where all of the props, the crutches that society wants to give us are swept away. And I think that all of us have to come to that. If we're really practicing, we have to come to that place in our practice. In the biography of Ajahn Chah, for example, even though Ajahn Chah spoke very much in praise of spiritual community and of the benefits that he got from the Sangha and from his teachers, but he also had at the point in his practice where he wanted to really develop his meditation very deeply, he also left everyone behind and went and practiced alone in the middle of the forest. So there's something about that. And I think we recognize this on an intuitive level. It's not easy to do, of course. If it was easy, then everyone would do it. But what strikes me is how different this kind of thing is than the way that meditation is packaged these days. And, you know, it is a packaging and it is a modern innovation to have sort of a room full of people sitting together for 10 days in a structured meditation retreat. This is a modern development. It's only been done for the last few decades. And it was invented by people like Goenka, who was a businessman and who was quite consciously packaging a way of doing meditation. So I always like this, something I always like, the formless, the unstructured, the intuitive approach to meditation. There's something about that, just getting inspiration from the rocks, from the trees, from the wind. I think we can be trapped inside meditation systems, meditation ideologies. We try to direct our minds to follow a particular course of development, which we've already got an idea what that is in our own mind, and that in some sense obstructs us from actually developing in that way. I think this is particularly true at the level of developing insight and vipassana. Somewhat less true, it's still true to some degree, but somewhat less true in the case of developing samatha. And I think in developing samatha and samadhi meditation, there's more to be said for having a structured meditation technique. But once we have deep insight, then the mind really has to go wild. I don't mean wild in the sense of just running around randomly screaming its head off, although that's always an option, but more just wild in the sense of being completely intuitive. And for all that we know that the Buddha praised spiritual friendship, he praised the support we get from a community, from a Sangha, and he praised the development of these kinds of healthy communities and relationships. But for all that, then there's still something that where our experience is just our own. We can't communicate it. We can't communicate. What does it feel like for each of you now as we're sitting here? We look inside our own hearts. That there's something about that experience which you can't share. And I think we all have that feeling in our life that it's so hard to find anyone who really understands you. Well, of course it's hard to find anyone who understands you. You have your own experience, your own lived consciousness, which other people really can't share. And they can only get you can guess from speech, from people's behaviour. You can intuit to a certain degree a person's mind state, but you can never really know what that is. You're still really just guessing, you know, where someone else is actually, the other person is living right inside that. What does it feel like to be here right now? And when we look at that, of course, it doesn't have any name. We don't look inside ourselves, and I don't see this as Bhante Sujato's experience. It doesn't have any status or anything. It's not like an abbot's experience and a monk's experience and a nun's experience and a layperson's experience or whatever. They don't have these kinds of things. In a sense, also, that direct experience doesn't have any history when we look at it. It's just there, it's present. In fact, it's overwhelmingly present. So, of course, obviously, our mind does have a history. It is conditioned by the things that's happened in the past, but those things are hidden. All we have is the result, which is present to us. So that present arisen experience, which is simply everything that there is, the things that we cognize through the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body and mind. That's all that life is. That's all ever is. Variations on that. There's nothing else. So this is one of the central tenets of Buddhism, that basically there's nothing outside of those things. There's no kind of special metaphysical realm which exists outside of those six senses. Eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind. So the Buddhist practice is to understand these things, to know them, to realize how the world which we take to be so solid, so certain, so dependable, is built up actually by a series of inferences from our assumptions derived from these six senses. So even though the immediacy, the actual arisen, that life, presence of life within each of us, is completely different. It's completely quite separate. But it's of a we infer or we assume that it is similar in other people. We see that other people, other humans, look somewhat similar to us. They behave somewhat similarly. We can communicate with them. We can relate to them. And so we infer that other people have a consciousness. Of course, this is a great philosophical dilemma in the problem of other minds. Does anybody else actually have another consciousness? But this is what we normally assume, that other people have other consciousnesses and that they're more or less the same kind of thing as we have, even though the specifics are different. And so this is the basis for understanding, the basis for compassion, the basis for love and hate of other people. There is another mind there. I was just thinking about my phone call to Telstra this morning and talking to this voice recognition software. Sounds human. And you can talk to it, it'll respond, but it's this peculiarly frustrating experience to have this thing that sounds human, but you know that no matter what you do, you can't get it across. And there's kind of a fundamental lack of empathy there. So we assume that other people have feelings. We assume that they have emotions. We assume that they have thoughts. It's a reasonable enough assumption. But we really know very little about what those thoughts and emotions and things are. It's true, in some cases, we can know things or see things that other people can't. Yeah? And so this is one of the ways that we can help each other. Sometimes we're blind to the patterns within our own mind. Other people, precisely because they're more distant, can sometimes see things that we can't. We get too caught up in the details and we can't see the patterns of things. And so this is why sometimes we can help each other. And so that's one of the basis that we have. We build proper spiritual relationships with this, to be able to listen to feedback, listen to admonishment and so on from each other, to be able to reflect within oneself and then see how we can change or improve. So this is one of the very great reasons we have a spiritual community. So this is why the Buddha said that somebody who can give us admonishment should be seen as like a gem or a jewel. You'd never relinquish it or give it away. It's something that's very precious. So if you ever find somebody who points out your faults, you should follow them around all day. Never leave them alone. Then they'll find fault with you and say, "You're following me around all day." And so that can be useful, but it's only useful to a certain degree. Once that's been pointed out, or once we can kind of see that or whatever, then it's still that ultimately, at the end of the day, it comes back to ourselves. And so it is, I think, with everything, that there's an acknowledgement in Buddhism that relationship level, that level of interaction, of course, is very important on any kind, in any number of ways. But still, at the end of the day, it comes back to ourselves. Birth, aging and death is something that we experience, that fundamental level of consciousness. That consciousness is very importantly and very crucially directed and shaped by culture and by society. We don't just stumble into meditation, for example, just by ourselves. We do it because we hear the word meditation, because we hear that it's talked about, because we see pictures of people meditating, because we're told that meditation can help us to deal with our stress, with our anxieties and so on. And so we become interested. We realize, oh, okay, yeah, I'm stressed. I can understand that. I feel anxiety sometimes. I'd like to find more peace. I'd like to find more happiness. So we can relate to that. And so we begin to look to meditation as being a solution, a more realistic solution. So, I mean, most people, you know, you can deal with your stress by just having a drink or by watching telly or by going to the footy or whatever, taking some Prozac or all these kind of ways that people do it, or maybe by exercising or something. All kinds of ways that people can cope with stress. And meditation's a way of doing that which is much more direct and much more powerful, much more profound. So when we do meditation, we're actually coming face to face with consciousness itself, the very source of all of these things, the very source of happiness and sadness, the very source of stress, the source of joy, and ultimately, according to Buddhism, the source of release, freedom, liberation. And so we're directed towards this meditative experience. And it's interesting that people come to that in all different kinds of ways. Some people just experiment by themselves and just try out a few things and try to learn how to meditate without really having much guidance. Some people do it by reading books. You read some book on meditation, sometimes read the Buddhist scriptures or something like that, and then just try to do it as best you can. But most people, I would think the vast majority of people in my experience, learn meditation from a teacher, having an actual present living teacher to learn from. Something I found to be quite interesting, or almost quite puzzling, when I first started teaching meditation, especially when I was in Malaysia, and we had all of these free distribution books in the Buddhist center of, like, you know, great masters like Ajahn Chah and other, you know, meditation, you know, masters who are obviously far more accomplished than I was at meditation. And people had these books and so on, but they'd come to me and then I'd say, well, try meditating like this, and they'd go off and they'd do that. So they, for the most part, people would learn much more from a direct teacher than from anything else, which I think is quite interesting. Of course, one of the reasons why that's so is because in a sense there's a kind of a personal validation of that this teaching is right for me. If there's a trust of the teacher, then And it's like, okay, this teacher says, use my mind in that way, then that must be the right thing for me. And there's also the chance for feedback, to ask questions. Is this right? Is this wrong? What do I do when this happens? And so you can develop that kind of relationship. But ultimately, of course, a meditation teacher has very little idea of what's going on in your mind. Even for those teachers who can read people's minds, they still don't really know what's going on in people's minds. Most people, most monks even, who can read people's minds, don't actually do it most of the time. I mean, would you? If you spent all that time purifying your mind and got this bright, pure, happy mind, would you go messing around in all these rubbish heaps around in front of you? It's the last thing you want to do. You go, ooh, gone, please, oh, give me a break. Generally speaking, my understanding is that those monks who can, or nuns or whoever they are, that can read minds, actually don't actually do it all that much, and then often people assume that that's the case. And I, as a teacher, give advice or meditation instructions and so on, I'm trying to do the best that I can on fairly limited information, and I can only go on what I see and what I hear. And so once we've got that direction, we've got that kind of general guidelines, then we have to take it, we have to put it into practice. So we can hear words like, okay, be mindful. So we have an idea in our mind of what being mindful is about. Okay, we try to be present. Try to be in the present moment. Try to not be wandering off thinking about this and that, but we try to be applying ourselves and keeping our meditation going with a kind of sense of self-awareness about it. So we try to do that. Of course, that's different for every person. The way that they do it, what's actually happening, will be different for every person. And say we hear meditation instruction, we should watch our breath, and the experience of the breath will be different for every person. There'll be something similar about it, but the way it is will be slightly different. There are different kinds of thoughts that arise. The different emotions that arise, the different way that the meditation develops, all of those will be quite individual and quite personal. And so this is why at the end of the day, even though a teacher can be useful, even though the spiritual friendship is useful, even though having a supportive community is useful, at the end of the day we're still thrown back on our own resources. I think Buddhism is quite an uncompromising religion in that respect. Don't have this idea, well, you know, you're going to be saved. And Buddha said that quite explicitly. I can't save anyone who doesn't help themselves. So as Buddhist practitioners, where there's that very definitely, I think, that sense, almost a sense of nervousness or fear about that we'll have to overcome this. We will have to be like Odysseus, just alone in the middle of the ocean, clinging onto his piece of driftwood, or we'll have to be like Gilgamesh, who walked for days and days through a pitch black tunnel, never knowing if he would see the other side. It's that kind of loneliness that can come in spiritual practice. So in terms of personal development, how much we do that will depend on us. It's not, you know, Odysseus did that after he'd already been through an incredible amount of adventures. So it's not that everyone should do that all the time. This is something that we need to do when we're ready. If we try to do it at the wrong time, then of course we'll fail. And so that's when people can go mad, or just give up, become depressed, and so on, when they're trying too hard. So this is where we need to value the support and the assistance that we get from others. And I know that often there's a feeling, and a very common feeling I had it myself when I was a young monk and people joining the monastery, that feeling like almost that other people are holding them back. That if it was just up to them, they'd be able to meditate more. That they'd be able to go further. And that there's just a distraction to have to do the chores. That there's too much activity in the monastery. Too much building or whatever it is. And so there's a feeling that everything's holding you back. But you shouldn't feel like that. That kind of feeling is based on conceit. If you're really someone who's really developed and mature, then they wouldn't feel like that. There's much more a sense of acceptance. The conditions are as they are, and an understanding that in any situation that there are supportive factors and unsupportive factors. That's just how it is. So we try to do the best we can to make it as supportive as possible, but that's not going to be the same or ideal for everyone. But there definitely will come and should come a time in our practice when we're really just going to want to do that. We're just going to want to go and just be by ourselves in the middle of the forest. However we manage to do that, some people just wander off by themselves. Some people go and find, like myself, found a kuti in the north of Thailand, just stayed there by myself for a year. Maybe it's a shorter period, maybe it's just a few weeks staying on retreat in a hut or something like that. But somehow, there's always, that feeling is always there. A feeling that when we really want to face up to the truth and then to discover ourselves, that is going to have to be alone. So this is my little talk for you this evening on solitude in practice, relationship between solitude and community life. So I offer this for your reflection and amusement. And if anyone has any comments or questions, you're most welcome.